The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson, Tom Fornelli, Danny Cannell, and Bud Elliott. It's your call for the best college football coverage from National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between. CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast. Here on CBS Sports, that's Tom Fornelli, that's Bud Elliott, I'm Chip Patterson, coming to you live at youtube.com/cover3 here Thursday, 11 a.m. Thanks to all of you that are joining. If you are listening to this after the fact in the audio format or watching along on YouTube, thank you very much. We will be tackling questions from the big old bag of mail. And the way that you can get in a mailbag question is to leave us a 5-star review. And in that review, put your question. We will add it to the big old bag of mail and tackle it in a future mailbag episode. Before we get into that, I do want to hit on a news story, a little bit of an interesting development, especially as it pertains to the Big Ten, as it pertains to the college football playoff expansion, and the way that the Big Ten individually and maybe college football at large goes through the scheduling process. So Gary Barta, the athletic director for Iowa, had a conversation with The Athletic in which he indicated that there are conversations relating to changing the Big Ten schedule beyond 2022. That would include, number one, the potential reduction of a conference game. So they would go from a 9-game conference schedule to an 8-game conference schedule. And number two, this would be eliminating divisions. The East has dominated the relationship between the East and the West. And as we look to the 24/7 Sports composite recruiting rankings, the division of East and West kind of almost looks like the daggum standings when you sort them all by how they are in the recruiting rankings. So, you know, there could be some balance of power that could change from the divisions. There are angles to this in terms of non-conference scheduling, the relationship with the ACC and the Pac-12, and the Alliance, all at hand right now. Tom, congratulations on the Chicago Bears getting a new head coach. We'll check in with our resident Big Ten expert first. What are you making of some of this movement that we're getting from the conference?
First of all, I'm kind of torn because as an Illinois person, the Big Ten West is good. Like when you're in the Big Ten West and you're not, you know, it's like, no, it's nice. I love divisions. It's a little bit, you know, there's more hope. And if you get rid of divisions, it kind of impacts your ability. It probably impacts your ceiling a little bit. But on the other side, just as a college football fan, I would be happy to get rid of the division. So I think that's probably a good thing in the long run, because I do think that, you know, like Bill Connolly's pod model that he's had for years and he's been touting for years is just pretty similar to what they're discussing, or what the report was discussing, in which the Big Ten teams would have their three permanent rivals that they play every year. And then whether it's 8 or 9 games, so 5 or 6, just kind of rotating opponents. So that way you're playing the rest of the conference a lot more often than you would now, because that's been one of the side effects of conference expansion, having so many teams. It's like you barely see any of these teams when they're not in your division anymore. It's like, you know, think about how many times Georgia and Alabama have met in the regular season compared to how many times they've met in the conference championship game. So I think for that aspect, it would be good. I'm not incredibly excited about going down to an 8-game conference schedule. I get that it makes more sense as far as balance of home and away and all that kind of stuff. And it also helps. It gives you another non-con opportunity to schedule the Pac-12 or the Big 12 or the ACC or whoever you want. And it'll also probably help more teams get to bowl games that way. But just as a fan, I have always preferred more conference games, because that's another way to make sure that you're seeing your conference mates more often, is playing more games against them. So frankly, in my ideal scenario, they would go to 10 conference games before they went to 8, but that's probably not going to happen. So I feel like it's a fair enough trade for me, where I will take the 8-game schedule if they get rid of divisions, and as long as there is some sort of agreement in there with the Alliance to schedule those kind of interesting non-conference matchups.
So I have a couple thoughts on this. One, I agree with a lot of what Tom is saying. I would hate going to 10 conference games if we don't have playoff expansion, because I feel like it would sort of be kind of like before we had interleague play in baseball. You know, and when you got to the postseason or you got to the All-Star game, it was a cool opportunity to see the teams that you don't see. From a power rating standpoint, I would absolutely hate the lack of connectivity between conferences.
Oh, yeah.
If we were to go to 10 conference games, which I know isn't really on the table. My brain just kind of went there as soon as he said that. I think if, you know, when we had Matt Brown on the show, he talked about the potential for a, not like a new Power Five only type thing, but maybe more of like an 80 team FBS. If you did that and you were only playing those teams, I think 8 plus 4 more legitimate non-conference games or tougher non-conference games would be really interesting. But the main thing I think you accomplish with pods is with an eye towards playoff expansion. And I think the one thing that they want to avoid is there's a very real possibility that we get AQ bids with a 12-team conference expansion plan, which probably won't happen until 2026 unless the ACC plays its leverage well and they get paid off earlier. But if you go to pods instead of divisions, you drastically increase the quality, most likely, of who is in the game every year. That way, you are very unlikely to have an 8-4 type conference champion come out of nowhere. So the playoff folks, there's no way in hell they're going to go for AQ bids, even though we love the drama of bid thieves on, you know, Selection Sunday or Saturday sometimes. But you guys see what I'm saying? Like, they want to ensure that the quality of the AQ, the automatic qualifier AQ from whatever conference games you have, has a certain floor to it. And if you go to pods, which I love, I think divisions are stupid and they should go to pods immediately. And you're going to guarantee a higher quality team gets an auto bid. Also, most of these teams don't legitimately have 4 rivals. They probably have 2 real rivals, mm-hmm. one that they think is a rival and the other opponent's like, okay, fine, sure. And then one they think is a rival and the opponent's like, we're not a rival. You kidding me? Like there's no rivalry here. In the SEC, that's typically, I think, Tennessee, right? They think that they're rivals with everybody. And they're like,
to be fair, the Big Ten does have trophies to show that there are many, many, many rivalries in that conference between those members. The normal fan is not going to go the extra step, I don't think, to actually like break down the pods. You know, the pods would be something that's handled at the league office. It's something that, right, if we're interested in, we continue to break down and cycle it. It's in the same way that the schedules, like the conference schedule in terms of the opponents that you play in the ACC, it's built out to 2036. Like, if you really care enough, you can go down and you can start pulling all this information. But I think for the normal fan, it's about looking at the standings and not seeing the divisions, but seeing it all right there. For the league, it is 100% about making sure that you get the highest quality of conference championship game. The Pac-12 had already discussed dropping from 9 to 8. The Pac-12 was already starting. George Kliavkov, you know, shortly after getting the job, he had already hinted at the idea of getting rid of divisions in order to allow for a conference championship game that would not have the scenario where your second best team in the conference misses the conference championship game because it loses the division. But then the best team in your conference gets upset by a team, to your point, Bud, that's 8-4, got in with 5-3 in tiebreakers from the other division. Now all of a sudden you're left without a college football playoff team. I wanted to ask this because I haven't had a conversation about this with a coach in a couple of seasons, but what do you think? There are coaches that I know like divisions. Is that for the familiarity? Is it the idea that, you know, planning and preparation allows you to, you know, keep your notebook together and have maybe a little bit of an edge? What do you think is the push for divisions? Because we've got a lot of reasons about why you should get rid of divisions and a lot of reasons why, whether it's giving fans more times to see opponents, whether it's allowing your conference championship game to be better quality and your champion to be better quality. What are the pros for divisions?
If you're a coach, I think you hit on the two bigger aspects of why they would prefer divisions, is because you know who you're playing every single year and you've got less new opponents to prepare for. Whereas while teams are changing on every single season, like if you're playing Mississippi State every single year and it's you've the got same your leash
book. Like yeah, this is the like, notebook that we break out for the Mississippi State week.
Yeah. So like you've got a lot to do in your job. You're pretty busy. There are a lot of things you have to do. So anything that you can find that kind of alleviates the schedule just a little bit is something you're going to prefer. Whereas if it's a rotating schedule every single season, that's different things you're going to have to prepare for. That's more time that you have to spend doing it. So from that aspect, I think that's probably the biggest reason why any coach would prefer the divisions. Other than that, I don't know. Maybe some just don't like traveling as far and being in the divisions if they're geographical keeps them from having to travel too much.
I would think so. It also, it's very self-interested. If you are in the Big Ten West, yeah, you probably love divisions.
Yeah.
You know who hates divisions? Mike Maryland, Loxley and Greg Schiano. Like, if you throw Rutgers and Maryland in the West, they're not laughing stocks, right? Like, they've been just as good, if not better, than Illinois recently. I mean, in many years, and Northwestern and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, realistically, guys, it's interesting for me to think which teams will benefit from divisions and which teams will probably be hurt, and how that changes how coaches view certain jobs. You know, if like Mississippi State becomes a better job if their rotating opponents are like what, Ole Miss, Alabama, because you'd probably have to give Bama a break on somebody they play. Like, you're not going to give Bama, you know, Auburn, Tennessee, LSU, I wouldn't think. And then maybe Arkansas or something like that. That means I get to play East teams a lot more often. That's great for me if I'm a Mississippi State or a Rutgers or, you know, Maryland, or if you're South Carolina, it probably becomes a harder job, which is crazy to think about. Or Vanderbilt, right? I mean, imagine if Vanderbilt had to play a lot more West teams. I do think this is going to happen, though, because the ACC was pushing for pods for a while, and I don't think they got any real traction on it as far as long-term. They were allowed to have non-divisional play during the COVID year because they had Notre Dame and an unequal number of teams. But now you get the Big Ten floating this, and it's very clear the SEC is going to do this at some point because they're not going to have
Texas and Oklahoma. Eight. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The only thing that might not do this would be the Big 12, I guess.
Which is already divisionless as it is.
Yeah. But it will be division. It will have divisions most likely when they add the four teams. Ooh, and they'll have 12.
At the very beginning, for sure. See, I think my problem here, too, is like, who benefits from this? Well, same teams that always benefit from it will benefit from it. The teams that are playoff teams or considered playoff contenders, those kind of teams will be the ones that benefit from it. And that is my concern with doing this. Like, again, the reason they're doing it is to position themselves better for the college football playoff. So it's just like, we're going to let the tail keep wagging the dog. It's like, why don't you do what's best for your conference instead of what's best for the playoff? But whatever.
Great comment from Texas or Busted in the chat. He mentions that coaches, one reason they might like it, hey, it's another banner, right? Like, if a division championship, you know, is something
contractual incentives.
Yeah, contractual incentives, and also just like as a motivating program building, you know, make it seem like just even getting to that conference championship game, you have won a championship to do so. One other thing before we hit the big old bag of mail. Chris Hummer on the show yesterday. If you have not listened to it, if you have not watched it, he was able to break down a lot of the latest on the transfer portal. He is, for my money, now on top of this, the ins and outs, what's the latest on all these different players. I have enjoyed, as a fan and as somebody who has to translate some of that information to you here on this podcast on CBS Sports HQ and elsewhere, I think he's doing a terrific job. And he has logged a new crystal ball projection for one of the top quarterbacks available in the transfer portal, and it's Jackson Dart. But Jackson Dart, you know, very, very high ceiling, showed it when healthy, showed flashes of what he could be. Ole Miss, BYU, Oklahoma are some of those schools that are in the mix. And this morning, as we record here on Thursday, Chris Hummer filed a crystal ball prediction for Jackson Dart to go to Ole Miss. He noted that Oklahoma and BYU are still pushing, but, quote, good shape is where Ole Miss is at right now. For Dart to Ole Miss, the idea of playing quarterback for Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss is going to bring a lot of, like, sure, makes sense. Like, if I'm in Jackson Dart's camp, I'm like, that is one of the places that I have high on the list. in any thoughts if this does go down in terms of what Dart can accomplish with the Rebels and with Kiffin? And then again, like I don't want to belabor the point, but does this do anything for you in terms of the man who, as Hummer told us, can literally just wait until the fall if he wanted to? Like, if he just wanted to hang out and train in the DC area and kick it all summer, he probably could, and coaches would still be fine with it. But clock's ticking. What do we make of Dart's the potential of Dart to Ole Miss and what it might mean for the Caleb Williams and the rest of the quarterbacks?
62% passer. I mean, 2-1 touch and interception ratio. Those are fine numbers in a limited sample set. I think the thing that gets people really excited about Dart is the physical ability is really, really good. You know, he got his chance when Keaton Slovis went down and shined pretty well for a true freshman. He was also one of those late risers in the rankings who had a really nice senior year statistically. And we do see that sometimes, these guys that maybe don't blow up till later in their high school career, and then the light finally goes on. Sometimes that is an indication they may be able to outplay their ranking. And certainly that's something with our rankings that we try to account for as best we can. So there's a lot of potential there. Lane Kiffin's offense sets up a bunch of just super easy throws that are going to juice your numbers to, you know, sky high. I think they would have been good with Luke Altmyer, but Altmyer's also a guy physically, maybe he needs a little more time to develop. If you can keep him in the system, which I kind of doubt because Dart's a freshman. I mean, if he goes there, is Altmyer really going to sit there the same year? Probably not. But you know, this could create more dominance because Altmyer was certainly a player who a lot of programs wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're Ole Miss, I don't know that Jackson Dart's as good as Matt Corral. Like, Matt Corral is pretty good.
Probably not yet, right?
Yeah, but I did like what I saw of Dart in his limited sample at USC, but maybe, you know, he'll be playing behind a better line and in a better offense, like design-wise, now that he's at Ole Miss, which might help him and help his development. So if you're the Rebels and you're a Rebels fan, I think you got to feel pretty decent. I don't know if you're going to be ending up back in a Sugar Bowl next year, but I do think that Dart coming in definitely raises the floor. Like, I feel like Ole Miss is like 8-4 at worst with Jackson Dart. So it's still a pretty solid top 25-ish, can compete top 15, top 10, and maybe New Year's 6 berth if things go well. So it's a reason to be excited for sure. But again, as we've talked about, I'm just waiting on Caleb Williams. That's all I care about right now.
It is very interesting. If let's say that hypothetically, so Dart follows through, Hummer's correct on his crystal ball. I would not bet against Chris Hummer with his crystal balls for transfers, by the way. Like, he's done a really good job on this and has established himself as like the guy for the kind of crystal ball oracle, almost like Wilt Fong is on the recruiting side. So that kind of leaves USC currently as Caleb or bust quarterback wise. Mm-hmm. What if USC doesn't get Caleb Williams? What are they going to look like this spring? Right now, granted, somebody will leave their current school. Free. Somebody good will be like, wait a second. I get to go play with those weapons at that school for Lincoln Riley? Yeah, I'm there. So I bet you there's a lot of schools out there that are rooting for Caleb to go to USC, because if he doesn't, they have to be worried they're going to lose their quarterback to USC.
Mm-hmm. What is that? I'm sorry to like spring this up. This is a really good thread. I'm glad you brought it up. I looked at it the other day. I feel like USC, if Caleb doesn't go, and if Caleb maybe isn't in spring practice, we're only dealing with what, like two scholarship quarterbacks for spring practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think they got the true freshman enrolled, didn't they? I'm trying to think here who's actually on this. Well, you know what? I can go to our USC 24/7 sports page, uscfootball.com, and I can look at their scholarship matrix. It's a cool tool that we have that I probably should just
I had Miller Moss, and then I had like one other either like walk on scholarship or an early enrollee and I was looking at it. And what is Miller Moss's deal? Is Miller Moss going to be the starting quarterback for the Trojans at the start of the 2022 season? Does he have a shot at that?
No, I would be shocked. Who will be? The prodigal son will return.
Jackson Dart?
JT Daniels will return to USC.
I almost broke my chair.
The circle will be complete.
Yeah, I mean, like, does Slovis leave Pitt and come back? Does Jackson Dart double back and just leave Lane hanging? I would say of all those, whether it's JT Daniels, Keaton Slovis, or Jackson Dart, if Caleb Williams goes to Wisconsin or somewhere else, I would think that JT Daniels to USC probably feels the most likely just because he's available, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think that there's, like Bud said, there's a QB we don't even know about yet who would probably this spring. Like, again, let's talk about that Ohio State QB room. Like, once CJ Stroud is named starter again after the spring, somebody in that room, if USC is open, might be looking over there like, I don't mind going back to California.
Oh, here's one for you. Let's get real deep in this thing. As Hummer speculated yesterday, one of the reasons Georgia is not going all in on Caleb Williams is because they're worried about guys clearing out of their room. Do you recall who was committed to Lincoln Riley at USC before flipping to Georgia? Because obviously everybody, I think eventually people realized that Caleb Williams was going to go to Oklahoma.
Vandegrift?
Brock Vandegrift, yeah.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. And isn't Vandegrift a Georgia boy? Isn't he from Georgia?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Take your talents out west.
Yeah, decommitted on January 1st of 2020, committed to Oklahoma June 20th of 19. So I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just trying to think, like, who would they go after? And I'm just trying to recall who they recruited in the same year as Caleb. So what about the loser of the Texas battle? You think Hudson Card?
Yeah.
Or Quinn Ewers? Well, I guess Quinn Ewers can't transfer again unless he somehow got a waiver. I don't know about. But
you can make a waiver. You can just, you know, do a forfeiture.
It's true.
And USC can create a mini mester. A lot of these guys can get waivers.
So the
could Antonio Brown's guy get a waiver made?
Yeah, it's a lot of people don't know this. Anybody can get a transfer waiver. You just have to go and print it out and fill it out, and you've made a waiver. Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Now, if you do that, don't stiff the guy who makes it for you, and then acknowledge receipt of it over text message. Mm-hmm. That is legal advice. Or, well, just common sense advice, I guess.
No. We'll, you're the...
That's
you're the
just good business. Legal. That's all that is. Yeah.
January 28th is the last day of drop ad for USC. Last day of drop ad for Wisconsin is February 4th. Today is January 27th, and this is where we are.
Dates are not real.
Yeah.
I know you're...
They're not real.
I know they're not real, but it... It feels as though it's important to keep in mind, because I can't imagine that you're going to be able to get that super, super late enrollment and also the ability to practice for spring, right?
Well, mini-mester.
Yeah, and I'm not 100% sure how this would work, but like the dates aren't real. Like Wisconsin's a public school, so the date might be a little more real there than it is at USC, which is a private school and can just change its rules.
Well, it's funny, as I was digging for the Wisconsin information, again, something I was not expecting to do in this Caleb Williams scenario when it first broke. The hilarious part was like, okay, you can do February 4th, but it's going to be a $50 fee. You're going to be able to float that $50 fee, Caleb? Yeah. Pretty sure Caleb's going to be okay with that one.
So I'm looking at the Hunt School of Business at Princeton, and they have four reasons to take a mini-mester, the benefits of a mini-mester. Caleb, if he wants to take a mini-mester at USC, he could deeply focus on one topic, Chip. That's a good reason. Discover the world with the traveling mini-mester. Maybe he takes a traveling mini-mester. It doesn't even get to USC until like March, right? Like he could take a
Caleb Williams gap year. Let's go, Caleb Williams gap year.
He could receive mentorship and practice teamwork during his mini-mester. That's reason number three to get a mini-mester. And explore real-world issues and solutions, like how to get around hard deadlines.
Do they offer bowling? Didn't Matt Leinart take bowling at USC?
We had bowling at Florida State.
Yeah.
Not as a minor, I don't think.
But. I got that state school shutdown that you're hinting at when I tried to pitch an independent study to count for a high-level comm graduation credit, and they laughed my ass right out of the office and back into the fall semester for just one more credit. Coming up on the other side, we dive into the big old bag of mail with a look into the future of the Big 12, what Jim Knowles might bring to the Ohio State defense, and more next.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Imagine sleeping in the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bull & Branch's iconic sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bull & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code Odyssey. So head to B-O-L-L and branch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A reminder, if you want to add a question to the big old bag of mail, you can do it by leaving us a 5-star review. And in that review, put your question. This question comes from Nitro's nephew. Shout out to Nitro.
You know, the American Gladiator Nitro?
Oh, you know the Nitro we're talking about. We're talking about UCF's mascot.
Oh, ooh, okay. Damn.
Listen, UCF's mascot at basketball games looks awesome because he wears wheelies on his tennis shoes. And so this big 6'9" inflatable knight, not inflatable knight, big puffy knight with a sword, whatever. All right. 6-star podcast, the best, most comprehensive podcast out there for any college football fan. They got knowledge, insight, and plenty of humor coming from a fantastic four of college football dynamos. Great to hear from the ghost of Barton Simmons during the early signing period too. Question. With four new schools joining the Big 12 in 2023, how long do you think one of them, if any, starts regularly competing for conference titles? And if so, which one? So to before we dive into this, the four schools that are joining the Big 12 in 2023, UCF, I'm sure that our questioner is interested.
I know what answer they want. Yeah.
Cincinnati, Houston, and BYU. So how long will it take for one, if any, of those four schools to be competing for Big 12 titles?
I don't think it'll take that long.
That was my instant reaction was like, I don't know, 2023?
Yeah, like I don't know that any of them are going to come in and be like the dominant team in the conference from the jump, but I think that they'll be in the hunt pretty much from right away. Like I don't see any of those programs being in a condition where they won't be ready to compete in the Big 12, especially because Texas and Oklahoma will be leaving the Big 12. So like the two big dog or one big dog and one little dog that barks loudly will be gone. And, you know, so there's going to be that kind of power vacuum. Now, I think that just familiarity with the landscape, familiarity with the opponents, kind of like we talked about earlier in the show with why coaches like divisions, everybody that's currently in the Big 12 will have a better idea of how to play against the Big 12 and what the rest of the teams are doing, whereas all these 40 teams will be scouting new teams, scouting new coaches, scouting new tendencies. So there's going to be an adjustment period. But I don't think, like, if I'm a UCF fan, a Cincinnati fan, a BYU fan, or a Houston fan, I'm not sitting there worried that I'm going to show up in the Big 12 and be going fighting to get 6-6 and 7-5 for a few years. I think you're going to be 8, 9, 10, 11 wins right away. As far as which ones are best poised, I don't know. If Luke Fickell's still at Cincinnati, I would lean there. If not, I would lean UCF. BYU, I think, will have a bit more of an adjustment period just because it's not used to being in a conference. But I don't think it's going to have a real big problem with it. And Houston's basically a Big 12 team already. So
that's exactly where my answer was going to start. Was let's think about what games you are losing and what opponents you are adding. And for the three teams coming from the American Athletic Conference, Cincinnati, Houston, and UCF, you are trading out Temple, UCF, Navy, and Kansas is still there. But even just above that, when you have to start dealing with Texas Tech, a TCU, West Virginia, that is a step up in competition. You are not going to have those weeks off, and I think you're really going to feel it. It's going to be more significant for BYU, who is going to be trading out your Liberty, your New Mexico State, some of those other independent games that fill out the schedule. And when you're trading that out, we're trading New Mexico State out for Texas Tech, then we're going to talk about, I think, a little bit more of an uphill climb. Of the Cincinnati, Houston, UCF, give me Cincinnati or UCF, I think, as the most likely. But my gut reaction to this was like, yes, there will be an adjustment. But if the new big dogs of the conference are going to be Oklahoma State, Baylor, and Iowa State, in the big picture, I don't think that UCF and Cincinnati are going to jump into that room and find themselves to be an underdog again, in the big picture, to the point where it's going to take 2 to 3 years to build up to the point of competition.
I got to say, I'm really excited to watch the new league from a close games perspective. Mm-hmm. If you power rate these teams,
yeah.
the vast majority of them are not top 20 teams, but they're sort of like very squarely in that 20 to 45 range in a given year, with the exception usually of Kansas. And sometimes Texas Tech drops down a little more in that 60 or 70 range. But the new league is going to have, what, 12 teams? I don't see any of them as consistent top 15 quality teams in the country, but somebody will probably emerge there every year. I highly doubt, just based on their recruiting, that it'll be a consistent team. I mean, you're going to have a whole lot of – are they playing an 8-game schedule or a 9-game schedule?
They play 9 now, but I don't know what they're going to do when they get to the 12.
I mean, you're going to have a boatload of 5-4 and 4-5, and you're probably going to have years where the two title teams are, you know, 7-2 and 6-3, just because I don't see anybody dominating anybody else for consistent stretches here based on their recruiting prowess and history.
Yeah, I think that's one thing you kind of touched on there too with the Big 12 is I don't know how much of a power it's going to be nationally as far as the playoff is concerned. But I think just as a fan of college football, it could easily be the most entertaining Power 5 conference on an annual basis, just because it might be the only conference where there's really not like the preseason, okay, that team's going to win it.
Yeah, which has been Oklahoma overwhelmingly over the last decade.
Like it's going to be the one Power 5 league with actual parity.
Yeah. Coaching then is where my mind goes. If we're just going to think that everything's going to be close games, who's got the best coaching? If like you said, if Luke Fickell's still at Cincinnati, then probably saying Cincinnati is the answer to this. But I mean, you're stepping in right now, and we're talking about 2023, but if the coaches were to stay in place, Mike Gundy, Dave Aranda, Matt Campbell, yikes, it's tough. It's going to be a tough top tier to crack even after the exodus of Texas and Oklahoma to the SEC. We get this question every now and then, and I try to be able to offer our wonderful college football minds that I'm joined with the opportunity to give this answer, because clearly the level of understanding with some of the verbiage we use is all over the place. And we want to make sure that we speak to the audience no matter where you're coming from with your love of college football. So this question comes from Jake. Great podcast. Love the insight and reasoning. Mailbag question. There are a variety of stats that each host mentions frequently on the show. Offensive, defensive success rate, explosiveness, and more. Can y'all break these down as to what exactly they mean and what important factors go into them, as well as how they correlate to a team's success on the season?
Well, let's just go right to the definition of it. I mean, it's defined in the glossary that Bill Connolly has. Obviously, he and Football Outsiders, and I think it was Aaron Schatz who first started doing this officially?
I think so.
This is like old school blogosphere stuff.
Yeah.
Which we all kind of fit into.
Yeah, I mean, that's we're dusty too.
So the official definition is basically a play is defined as successful if it gains at least 50% of yards required to move the chains on first down. So first 10, if you get it to second and 5 or better, 70% of yards on second down or 100% of yards on third or fourth down. So basically, you know, if it's second and 10, you need to gain at least 7 yards to be considered a successful play. Or if it's third down, you need to gain 100% of yards to be considered a successful play. It's a good measure of how consistent a team is being, especially early in the season. I like to look at that more than explosiveness, because I feel like explosiveness doesn't stabilize quite as quickly. The way I really think of success rate is like, how good are you? First of all, like, how consistent can you be? But how good are you at staying in situations where the defense actually has to respect play action? You know, are you staying in situation? And granted, like, a lot of coaches are coming around to this, but when this first came out, they're like, hey, man, 3.5 yard run on first down is good. Like, is it? It's kind of good if you're first and goal at the 8, potentially, but yeah, that's kind of the definition and how I think of it. Like, are you staying in a situation where the defense might have to respect the run, so play action is feasibly better?
Mm-hmm. And the reason explosiveness matters is, and again, there are different ways to define an explosive play. Like, depending on where you go, some places have different. I have my own different version of it that's not far off from like the SP plus kind of metric, but it's slightly different. But basically, why it's important is, like, success rate's great and you want to be successful. And if you could be successful 100% of the time, you'd never be stopped. But you're not going to be successful 100% of the time. So big explosive plays correlate to teams being able to score points because it keeps drives alive and it takes away, like, if a 25-yard pass takes away a quarter of the field. Like, if you've got to drive 75 yards for a score and you get one 25-yard play, you've covered a third of the ground in only one play. So it's just that kind of, like, you know, like, wherever you are on the field, your chances of scoring increases or decreases. Explosive plays increase your chance of scoring. They increase the odds your drive will be finished in the end zone. So that's why success rate and explosive plays correlate well to winning.
So do you each have your own success rate formula? Because I know that success rate goes into SP plus and is one of the major factors in it. And, you know, there are other efficiency ratings as well that probably have some version of success rate, but is there a place where you all are grabbing success rate and being able to identify some of these edges?
My overall success rate is the standard. I have different ones inside the 40 and inside the 20.
Yeah. So we're doing similar things. They're essentially adjusting for field position. I'll give away something here that I don't think it's really given away. I don't want to presuppose people haven't thought of this, but I think certain field position situations dictate that it is okay to throw behind the sticks or in front of the sticks rather on third down. So I don't necessarily grade that as a negative as long as you're willing to use all four downs.
You've got to go into it. Like, if you, it might not be successful because you didn't gain all of the yards to gain, but if it was part of a game plan based on your field position where you were then going to go get it in fourth, does it then trigger, like, if you get the fourth down, then it becomes positive? Or if you fall short, is it then negative?
Right, but it's team dependent based on willingness to go for it on fourth downs. So, for instance, I would not apply that to NC State, A&M, some of these teams that play kind of Cro-Magnon ball. Right. Just, oh, we only get three downs. Like, they haven't realized there's a fourth that you can use. But for other teams, this is sort of, and Connelly's wrote about this. So I don't have, like, I'm not giving away any of his secrets here. Like, Army is never going to look okay in success rate.
Yeah.
Because you're not dividing by three. You're sort of using a divider of four. So you have to kind of make an adjustment for some of these service academy teams if you believe that success rate is predictive. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're trying to figure out what's going to happen next, you need to understand kind of how teams play.
Who's a good team that has good success rate, but it doesn't correlate as well? Like, if in NC my State. Head, okay. So NC State's success rate is strong, but they had a lot of wins. I mean, this was a successful season.
They did. They also had a very cushy schedule, and like, I was on them. I think we all took them over their win total. Six was a ridiculous win total when that came out. Now some places have them eighth in their preseason poll. And I'm like, they could play like a top 10 team. In close games, will they coach in a smart enough fashion to use, like, to actually use all the resources, like their downs that are given to them? Mm-hmm. And that's, like, it doesn't affect your season in a huge way, but in the close games, it does seem to matter a little more.
Yeah, like, if just going off this list right now, just there's some teams that you might be surprised to see, like, top 10. Like, if you look at number one in success rate on offense this year was Georgia. Sure. Then Cincinnati, Ohio State, Coastal, A&M, Louisiana, Air Force, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin is something that would probably surprise some people, considering how stodgy and Cro-Magnon-ish their offense is, that they had such a high success rate. But that's kind of because what they do works. Marshall was a team that's tied with a few others. They're in, like, just outside the top 10. There are some teams where you look that's kind of surprising, that when you think of how you view their offense just based on results, you'd be surprised to see how successful they are.
That Marshall offense, led by now Virginia Tech quarterback Grant Wells.
Mm-hmm.
Hokies got themselves a new quarterback from the portal for Brent.
And Virginia Tech took the OC from Georgia State, and they do a lot of really interesting QB run stuff. So I'm interested to see how that works out.
Very interesting. All right. Well, thank you for taking us to school right there. I think that we end up somehow mentioning it once or twice every single year. But for those who are new listeners, and we have seen the numbers, there are a lot of new listeners that have jumped on board during this college football season, and we really appreciate all of you. So we want to keep everybody up to speed so that when we're talking about success rate and explosiveness, you know where we are coming from. All right, let's take a look at the Big Ten. We were discussing the divisions earlier. This question comes from Santan Valley Buckeye. Love the show, the best national CFB pod out there. My mailbag question is, what are your thoughts on the impact that first-year defensive coordinator Jim Knowles will have on the Ohio State defense? Despite the schematic and execution struggles, the 2021 defense always felt like the parts were greater than the whole, especially with so many young players contributing. He mentions Sawyer, Burke, JTT. The floor for the 2022 defense can't be worse than 2021, but what is a realistic ceiling? Will it be enough to win the college football playoff? RIP Barton.
I mean, it's hard to know for sure, but just based on what Knowles was able to do at Oklahoma State with the talent level of player he had there, I think it's logical that when he improves his talent base as far as who he has on his defense, it's probably going to work out pretty well for Ohio State. And that has been the weakness of that team the last couple of years. Defensively, they just haven't been as good as they were in the years prior. Like, you know, they had the elite pass rush. They had like 75 first round defensive backs on the team, and they were, you know, getting to the national title game, winning national title. So I think it's good. I think that it's probably going to work out pretty well. But like, if Ohio State wins a national title, I don't think it's just going to be because of Jim Knowles. I think Ohio State's already capable of winning a national title. And had it not lost that game to Oregon this year with Kerry Combs calling plays early in the season, Ohio State might have won the national title this year. So if you want to look at it from that way, say Kerry Combs cost him a chance to do it this year. So if they win one next year, then it's definitely all thanks to getting rid of Combs, bringing in Jim Knowles. Sure. But Ohio State's already capable of winning a national title.
So let's go back to what Chris Hummer said yesterday about how Ohio State didn't want to take Eli Ricks because they were worried about a lot of the young guys in that corner room who they really like transferring out. There's a couple things to take away from that. Obviously, roster management is very new in the portal era. I also took away that they like a lot of these guys in their secondary talent-wise. Knowles is a pretty proven quality defense coordinator, and he's not starting from a defense that ranked, you know, 100th last year. I think FPI, defensive efficiency, had him like 26th. SP Plus had him as the number 20 defense in the country. They did a really good job of shutting down bad offenses and making them look bad. They just at times were, you know, struggling somewhat against some of the better offenses they faced. And there was a bit of like a covariance thing. They would, you know, hammer these really, really bad teams, but then not really stack up against some of the better teams. If they still have the number one offense in the country, and it'll be them or Bama, right? Unless I'm missing some real challenger, maybe Texas, if everything goes totally correct, I guess.
USC?
Sure. I guess USC could, but they lose Drake London.
Right.
If Knowles can get them to, like, I don't know, the 12th defense, LSU won with a historically great offense and defense, I think, was like 18th or 19th.
Mm-hmm. And LSU's defense also got on a hot streak. Like,
it did.
I remember that was big story. Like, that was my, you know, you go write a big story, you know. Okay, I guess I'm gonna write about LSU's defense. But talking to Dave Aranda about it a while, he mentioned that it was something where the team was getting healthier. Remember, Grant Delpit had some injuries. He was able to get back into the lineup. They were able to do some more things that allowed them to be flexible, versatile. And we can see by the talent that's in the NFL now, it wasn't like they were short on dudes. The LSU example might actually be great. You need a hot defense. You need a defense that's gonna start playing really well. You know, especially if you're going to, we're talking about win the national championship, you need a defense that's going to be playing really well and have some health injury luck in those key times of the year when you're playing Michigan, when you're playing the Big Ten championship game, and when you're playing the college football playoff. I think that Ohio State's defense can reach 12th, but I think that more than anything, we look at the LSU example and we say that Ohio State's defense has the dudes that if they all get it going in the right direction at the right time, then it's absolutely could be the last piece of the puzzle to actually win in the Natty, not just showing up in the playoff.
The other thing in that game, Chip, that for that LSU team, this is way off course, but I guess it's the off season, right? The one game that I remember having to kind of manually adjust LSU's stats for, like I went and bumped their defense, was Ole Miss, right? Because Ole Miss kept hitting explosive run plays, and it was very clear that LSU knew they would score every time, basically. And they scored 58 points on them, and had, it was 31-7 at one point. And LSU's defense like, yeah, we're not really into stopping the run with a 24-point lead. And Ole Miss is like, Lane Kiffin, to his credit, is like, well, we're going to hit explosive runs on you all the time, which is cool. Or was it Kiffin then? Or no, that was wasn't that the Rich Rod? Yeah, that but Rich Rod, or was it? Sure, I think it was. I think it was Rich Rod.
Yeah,
and so he was running this, you know, explosive QB run stuff with John Reese Plumlee and hitting that on him. To me, that was sort of like fakery, and this is why watching the game still matters too, right? The stats are going to see that as, hey, this is not officially garbage time yet, and LSU's players and coaching staff's like, yeah, it is, right? Like, you got to sometimes take out some of these things. That's a wild tangent. Apologies.
Well, Oklahoma, so to put a button on Knowles specifically, what did Oklahoma State do as well as about anybody in the country? It was get in the backfield. Number two in the nation in sacks, number two in the nation in tackles for loss. They were tremendous. And while
that is something Ohio State has sorely lacked despite its talent level.
Yes, that is the one thing that that I think Ohio State fans would like to see again, was the kind of, you know, terrorizing defensive front. And so that's going to be one place where I would look at where you should see some instant impact. All right. From the coaching carousel, this question comes from Pat. What is Washington's ceiling under Kalen DeBoer? What do you think of the staff hires? Shepard feels like a nice get at receivers coach.
I mean, it's hard to say, honestly. He did a good job at Fresno State, so that's intriguing and that's interesting, but it's really, like, we've seen when Chris Peterson's there, if they recruit well enough, Washington's got a pretty decent ceiling. It can get to the college football playoff. If things go right, it wins the division, but it's also happened at a time where USC was not USC. Oregon was in a bit of a little downturn itself, so if I'm a Washington fan, I'm probably, I like the hire, but I'm probably a little tepid. Like, I'm not getting too gung-ho about it. I think that there's a lot of work left to be done. If your goal is to be winning the Pac-12 and getting to the playoff, I don't think Washington is super close to that right now. I think it's going to be a few years before we should even consider that. I would just like to see improvement and a more enjoyable team to watch more than anything right now.
And for context here, Jamarcus Shepard is the Shepard that was hired. He was the wide receivers coach at Purdue. Purdue's had some, you know, wide receivers have been pretty good for them. So I would understand why a Washington fan would be excited seeing that you're bringing in Jamarcus Shepard as in terms of creating more explosive plays and being able to have difference makers and coach up difference makers on the perimeter. I understand why you're excited. But I think that we all gave kind of a, yeah, like thumbs up to Kalen DeBoer. It's very difficult to set specific expectations, but, you know, where are you at with a little bit of time to start thinking about the Huskies moving forward?
Yeah, so you can recruit well at Washington. You can recruit kind of at a top 20 level if you're doing the job. Maybe some years you can go, you know, top 15-ish. I think Jamarcus Shepard, first of all, I think DeBoer will score points. The guy is a very bright offensive mind and has scored points pretty much everywhere he's been. And when he has left places, a lot of times they have not scored as many points. So that's also a decent indicator that you know what you're doing. I think at certain schools, it makes sense to go defensive coach if they're a tremendous recruiter, could be a great CEO, whatnot. But a lot of times, like, taking the destiny into your own hands and being the play caller, and that I think probably helps. Jamarcus Shepard, I agree, actually, is a good hire. I know Jamarcus a little bit. Purdue, I think he did a really nice job with their receivers. Obviously he got David Bell, so that was helpful, but they also had a lot of guys who were pretty productive under his watch. He also was with Mike Leach for a year. Leach is a noted pretty good passing mind. And I think just getting to work and be the passing game coordinator around Jeff Brohm helps as well. So they have a guy who, granted, like, I don't know how much, like, he wasn't calling the plays, but just being around Brohm that much probably can't hurt. And we know the guy's a good recruiter as well. So I would agree. That's a fairly good hire for them.
All right. And then one final question. If you listen to us draft top 25 teams at the beginning of the week, remember, and this is, I've actually gotten follow-ups to Monday's podcast during some radio hits this week. So clearly it's something that resonated. A lot of people enjoyed the show. Remember, we were drafting teams at the end of the season. We're not talking about preseason hype. We're not trying to predict what all these AP voters and hype beasts are going to be doing in August. We're trying to predict the way it's going to go at the end of the year. It also led to an interesting follow-up question from De Coast Guard Bears. Hey, guys, what team in the fantasy draft earned the most points but went undrafted? And what team was drafted and scored the least amount of points?
Well, I'll list three teams for the most points that went undrafted. There were two tied for second with 25 points each. That was Oklahoma State and Pitt, neither of which was drafted. Oklahoma State reached the Big 12 title game, went to the Fiesta Bowl. Pitt won the ACC, went to the Orange Bowl. Or not the Orange Bowl, the Peach Bowl. Yeah. But the most points for an undrafted team was the team that Oklahoma State lost to in the Big 12 championship game. That would be Baylor. Who had 26 and won the Big 12, and that conference title is what edged them just past Oklahoma State. As for the teams that were drafted, the least points scored overall belonged to Danny, who took Indiana, which got him 4 points, 2 wins, 2 covers. The Hoosiers were 2-10 overall, 2-10 against the spread, did not reach the postseason, so there are no bonus points. But since Danny's not here, I don't think it's fair to just dump on him. So I will list the other worst teams that any of us drafted. Chip, your worst team was TCU. It got you 7 points. My worst team was USC. It got me 8 points. Bud's team in the regular season was by far the most solid. Bud only lost because of what happened in the postseason. But Bud's worst scoring team was Marshall at 14.
So Bud's worst team got twice the number of points that my worst team did.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I had that floor. I just my team's in the postseason.
Yeah, Bud was the SEC West. It didn't win the title, but it was probably the best all season.
Yeah, they were chanting the name at the end of it.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about this, by the way. Would Pitt have been because we could only take one team from each conference. So we took 4 teams from the ACC.
No, you could take wild cards. You could have taken more ACC teams.
Oh, we could?
Yeah. We had wild cards.
What?
Because
I didn't take anybody from more than one league.
I took 2 Big Ten teams, Wisconsin and Penn State. I took 2 SEC teams, LSU and Ole Miss.
Mm-hmm.
There was an opportunity.
Yeah, it was 5. You had to have a minimum of 1 from each Power 5. There were 3 Group of 5s, and then there were 2 wild cards or flex spots.
Florida and Alabama for Tom.
Yep.
Okay.
Did you really just spray the board? Well, you got Notre Dame in there, so that's already kind of a wild card-ish.
Yeah. I had 1 from the Big Ten, Iowa, Nevada, Marshall. You know, I did well. I did pretty well with the G5 picks.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I just, none of them cashed it in. Like, I needed Marshall or Nevada or App to actually, win their
Toledo.
Or Toledo, right. But Toledo didn't make the title game.
They did not make the title game, but they at least were, a top 3 or top 4 team in the MAC.
It is funny, by the way, in our next teams to make the playoff draft, I took both Michigan and Cincinnati, which for the first time making the playoff. And Danny and I had the bet for Cincinnati playoff against Tom. Yet Tom drafted Cincinnati in our fantasy league with a relatively high pick. It's wild. It's genius.
I didn't take him for the playoff though. I took him because I was like, oh, they're going to win the American.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, they were a lock. Lockish, I guess.
Hmm. I had 1 conference champion. Shout out to you, Utah. I will always appreciate what you did for me in the Cover 3 fantasy league. We will be doing that activity again, but because it is more of a season preview activity, we'll do it a little bit later on. If you would like at least our way too early thoughts on some of these teams without any of the roster complications of checking off, the 5 conferences, the G5, the wild cards. We did do that top 25 team draft, and we went all the way to 10 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all the way to 10 rounds. So 40 teams discussed on Monday's podcast. what was the one team that was not brought up much that we didn't even talk about in the after? I've got this answer here, but it was Iowa State. We didn't even mention Iowa State as like a snub.
The one that I think will prove to be the highest rated one is Boise. Taking a look at Boise's schedule, I didn't grade this correctly. Like, otherwise, I'm on hindsight, but I think I would have taken Boise. Look at their 22 schedule. If they improve at all, which is possible because they have a second year coach, and you know, after being in very kind of same system for a while, so they're at Oregon State, they are at UTEP, and they play BYU. But I mean, they'll be favored over SDSU at home, favored over Utah State. They go to Nevada, but that's a major rebuild. New Mexico at Wyoming, probably a rebuild there. Colorado State at Air Force. I mean, there's a fairly decent chance of 9-3 or 10-2.
Also, they had, like, for the Iowa State thing, and I don't think we hate Iowa State, but I would like to point out that Iowa State went 6. I'd also like to point out that Iowa State has finished the season ranked in the AP poll twice since 2000, once in 2000 and then in 2020. That's it. So I don't think we're being crazy by not drafting Iowa State.
I think,
did people really respond with Iowa State?
Oh, in the chat. Iowa State fans are convinced that you hate Iowa State.
Why do you think they're leveling up? Their recruiting is not drastically improving. I mean, you hit on a lot of guys. I don't know. I'm going to crush some dreams right now.
Boise State, go ahead.
Your ability to drastically outplay your recruiting ranking is almost never sustainable. You need to take the success you have on the field and translate that into better recruiting rankings. Those little magic, like, we're better than recruiting rankings pixie dust is not as sustainable as fans of the teams that managed to do it in a limited sample think it is. It's not a real long-term strategy for the most part, especially not if you think you can level up to compete in the top 25 in that range. If your goal is consistently go 7-5, make bowls, which is honestly, I think, what the goal should be at Iowa State, and they're going to hate me more for saying that now, then yeah, you can keep doing it. But 7-5 in the Big 12 does not get you ranked.
To further your Boise State point in terms of, you know, what we're looking at to flip from one year to the next, this is a Boise State team that defeated the eventual Mountain West champions, Utah State, on the road, defeated BYU on the road, defeated Fresno State, dominated 40-14, and fell 11 points short at San Diego State at the end of the season from, I believe, finishing via tiebreakers, having a chance to play for the Mountain West Championship. There was a very complicated, like, three-way tie scenario that would have gotten them there, but it would be 5 straight wins to close the season if they were able to beat the Aztecs. Again, road win at Utah State, a one-point loss against Oklahoma State, road win at BYU. There was enough evidence in that Boise State season to suggest that flipping a 7-5 to 9-3 or 10-2 might not take that many different bounces.
Also, keep in mind, they are sort of the reverse Minnesota 2019. So I always keep a Minnesota 2019 list, which is teams that played a whole lot of backup quarterbacks, because, like, that's not sustainable year to year, most likely. But they're sort of the reverse, like teams who had to play a lot of good quarterbacks who went on to miss time. Most notably, they had to face UCF with Gabriel. And then he got hurt almost immediately thereafter against Louisville. So, you know, like, they're getting dinged in the rating systems for losing to UCF at full strength. The rating systems, most of them probably don't know that Gabriel went down and UCF ended up having a bad year. So, you know.
And that was a 5. That was a bananas game, too.
Yeah, it was.
4-hour lightning delay for the season opener. Was it Boise State got out to that huge lead, and then you end up having the comeback? It's a crazy, crazy game. You can jump in with a question for a future mailbag episode by leaving us a 5-star review. Put your question in the review. We'll tackle it in a future episode of the mailbag. I mean, you see what time of year this is. We are going to have some National Signing Day coverage coming up next week. Make sure that you're subscribed to the YouTube channel at youtube.com/cover3. Smash that bell for notifications so that you know when we go live. So we're going to be getting you before National Signing Day, letting you know what some of the storylines to watch, some of the names, some of the teams as they are jockeying for the final positions in the 2022 rankings. Then on National Signing Day, we will be coming to you with some signing day reaction and coverage. Again, subscribe to the YouTube channel, smash the bell so that you get the notifications when we go live, and that'll be the best way for you to be able to keep up with all the Cover 3 signing day coverage. You can follow him on Twitter at Tom Fornelli. You can follow him at BudElliott3. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Bears are back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.